The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 29th, 2017. Wow, it's been quite a week out there in the bicycle world. Chris Froome won the Tour de France. Little surprise there. Floyd Landis has claimed that his drug dealer was Alberto Contador's coach. Annemiek van Vleuten won the women's La Course after coming back from a horrific crash in Rio last year. And Peter Sagan shaved his head. All those beautiful locks, gone. I hardly recognized him when I saw a picture of him. Another state, Colorado's trying to pass a bike tax law. And Google is trying to figure out how its autonomous cars will recognize all the things that cyclists do on the road. So I appreciate that they're spending that much time doing research. They're doing most of it in Pittsburgh with a set of Uber Volvo cars. This week, we're going to wrap up the Tour de France, as promised, with my man in the know, Dan Worry. Then we're going to head on up to Boulder to speak with multi-champion triathlete Lauren Goss. Lauren has stood on the podium of every race she started this year, and she's poised to keep right on doing that. We'll do our usual take a break, and we'll then speak with the founder of Yuba Cargo Bikes, Ben Sarazen. We haven't covered cargo bikes much in the past, but Ben's company recently launched a new model that looked so interesting and, well, I wanted to know more about the bike and the category. So it is off to South Carolina, and we're going to wrap up the 2017 Tour de France with all its foibles and speak with Fellow News' Dan Worry. Hi, Dan. Here we are again, as promised. Tour de France ended last Sunday. What?
21 days yeah. In France. We're all done.
What a tumultuous 3 weeks, huh?
Ooh, it was.
Yeah, let's break it down a little. So what was surprising this year, beginning with Peter Sagan, of course?
Well, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about Peter Sagan at length. That was certainly a surprise. You know, I don't know that it has changed. You know, certainly didn't change the outcome of the general classification and the, you know, the overall lead. But, you know, Sagan had won the green jersey for a number of years in a row. Certainly, you know, in my estimation, was poised to do it again. So that, you know, I guess that was one of the big surprises of the tour, was the green jersey competition. You know, we lost Sagan, right, as he was ejected by the jury very questionably. We lost Mark Cavendish in the, you know, in the crash with Sagan. That questionable crash, and he fractured his shoulder. Eventually, we lost Marcel Kittel, we lost Arnaud Démare, and so, you know, the most prominent sprinters in the race, other than Bling Matthews and André Greipel, were sort of out of the mix by the time we got to Paris, and so, you know, a great opportunity for Michael Matthews of Sunweb to sort of step up and to claim that green jersey, but, you know, it's always you don't want to take anything away from him. He's a tremendous rider, but you know, there's always that game of, well, you know, what would have happened if everybody else had been healthy and there. But that's just sort of the nature of the tour.
Yeah, it seemed to be a sort of a bang up tour this year. A lot of people got hurt. Wow. There were some pretty severe injuries. I think everybody is sort of on the mend right now, but you know, it was not a pretty sight this year.
No, and you know, I think the other big story here, at least in terms of kind of prognosticating going into the tour, was the question of Richie Porte of BMC. He had had a great season to date, and was someone that a lot of people were looking at very strongly as really even a favorite over Chris Froome, going into the tour, and to have lost him. I'm sure you saw the crash. He kind of went off the road.
Yep.
on a curve. He's lucky he didn't go over down the embankment. But boy, slid across the pavement and hit a mountain in essence, and smashed up against those rocks and. Was injured quite badly and broke his collarbone. And so, to have Richie Porte in particular out of that general classification competition was certainly an advantage to Chris Froome and, probably made the race a little less interesting in terms of the GC, but it gave a chance for riders like Rigoberto Urán of Cannondale Drakepack to pop up. I'd say not a huge surprise that Chris Froome won the race again for his fourth time this year. Although, what was different about the tour this year, Diane, was that, there were very few big mountaintop finishes that Chris Froome is, so well known for, a little bit less of an emphasis on time trialing as well. So this was a course where, people were really questioning, was this going to be Chris Froome's year? And so the fact that he was as consistent as he was and turned out such a good showing, it was a great credit to him. He continues to adapt and grow as a rider and, shows how strong he is. He didn't win a single stage of the tour, but managed to win the GC.
Which is interesting. People wonder how that works, but you just have to understand the timing and how the race is sort of scored. I want to go, even though we've sort of beat this horse a little bit, I want to go back and talk a moment about the situation with Peter Sagan and the officials making the wrong choice. Do you think this will bring any rule changes going forward?
Oh, gosh. I just think this was a bad choice on the judge's part. I don't necessarily think that it was a shortcoming in the rules. Though, one of the things that maybe could use some reexamination in the rules is this question about the decision of the race jury being final. I think, there was some question as to whether, the UCI could step in and overturn that. I do think that was a decision that was made that as additional footage of the crash came out, I think a reasonable person would be pretty hard pressed not to think that that was the wrong choice. Looking at some of the video that came out later, Peter Sagan did eventually appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and they, declined to step in and overturn that. So, maybe there is some opportunity to look at, whether there should be some higher level appeal within cycling itself would be an opportunity. But, I'm not sure that this was something that requires a rule change as much as it was just a blunder from the race jury, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it certainly was, and from what everybody else could see also. Overall, these 3 weeks, do you think, and I know this is really an opinion I'm looking for, do you think some of the luster has faded from the tour, that it's not the race that it used to be? Has anything, something about this year's race didn't feel as exciting or as, compelling as it used to?
Just in terms of opinion, I would kind of disagree with that.
Oh, good. Okay.
here was a tour where we had, a very different course than I think we're used to. I think, one of the things that people look at each year as that course is unveiled is, how many kilometers of time trialing, and is it flat or is it uphill? Is it, are there these big mountain finishes? This was an unusual course this year, and that we didn't have some of those elements in the course this year that are so advantageous to a rider like Chris Froome, which is, kind of getting back to our previous discussion, why, there was some doubt as to whether this was going to be his year, or, definitely a feeling that this was going to be the hardest course for him to win that he ever had. And so if you look at, how things unfolded across 3 weeks, in a lot of ways, this was one of the more unpredictable and exciting tours in my mind that we've seen recently. There have been some of Froome's victories here in the past have been pretty well squared away right from the beginning. But here this year, Froome actually lost the yellow jersey for a period of time to Fabio Aru of Astana. And so, and even going down to those final couple days of the tour, I mean, we had a general classification that was I think it was 6 seconds, between Froome and the second place rider there going, even getting down toward Paris. So it really wasn't until that final Saturday time trial that Froome managed to, to put some time into Uran and Romain Bardet to really decisively clinch. He ended up winning by 54 seconds, but prior to that time trial, it was, I'll blank on the exact, but it was it was less than 10 seconds. So
yeah, you're right. You're right.
That's a pretty exciting tour.
Yeah, that is. From that perspective, yeah. For some reason, some of the things that happened, so all the crashes and people getting hurt, and somehow took away from some of the excitement for me. I just felt like it was carnage. There seemed to be a lot of carnage this year.
If you think back over the past couple of years, every edition of the tour has a fair amount of carnage. It was interesting that a lot of that carnage happened to be in the sprint classification this time, and really took away most all of the big names in the green jersey competition. But if there were other surprises, I would tell you, Nairo Quintana of Movistar just sort of disappeared. I mean, here's a guy that we expect or have expected in the past couple of years to be a major contender. Now, his strength is certainly, the big mountain climbs. And so, with a course lacking in certainly not entirely lacking in them, but lacking in as many as have been, but to see Quintana, finish 15 and a half minutes behind Chris Froome is really pretty remarkable.
Yeah, that is. You're absolutely right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with our man, Dan Worry, about the Tour de France this year, but I'm going to take a left turn here and we're going to talk about podium girls for a moment. So the Vuelta has decided no podium girls. Now, I'm in favor of women's rights and a little bit of feminism, but I'm personally not offended by podium girls. They've been around forever. Now, if a rider, reaches over and grabs some girl's ass, it does bother me. That I don't like.
Sure. But that has happened.
And it has happened. In fact, we've actually seen pictures of that happening. But for the most part, I don't understand what the harm is about having women up there. I don't think they're really being objectified. So what's the Vuelta going to do? Have podium boys?
Well, there are races. The Tour of the Gila in New Mexico here over the past several years has actually had podium boys for the women's race. It's a tough question. This is a something that to a lot of people they see this as a real part of the tradition of cycling having podium girls. Many don't see a lot of harm in it. I think though the question is the presence of the podium girls sort of there as trophies or as decorations on the stage, I think sort of takes away, and particularly as women's cycling is, advancing at the level that it is, it's been very exciting in recent years to see the growth of women's cycling, to be able to honor women as athletes as opposed to decorations up on the stage. I have a conflict of interest here, Diane. I do like I like to see a pretty girl. I won't lie, but you know whether they need to be there as trophy objects, I'm not sure. So actually, I'm not at all opposed to what the Vault is doing.
No, I guess I'm not opposed to it. I just don't see them as trophy girls. I just see them as the ones presenting the flowers, and you know, I don't know. I just. Pretty girls are pretty girls, and pretty boys are pretty boys. I don't mind that. I'd like to see more men up on the podium. That would work for me for the women's races. All right, so we can agree to disagree or not. Last thing is, and you said it was hilarious. I did watch it, Tour de Pharmacie. Oh, my. It was the most irreverent, outrageous thing I have seen in a long time. I don't even know what we can actually say on the air, but let's try.
Yeah, I said, I think last time I was there, and I've written about this in the new issue of Elle News that is coming out. You know, I'm very torn about Tour de Pharmacie. I've got to say, it really was hysterical. I mean, there was a lot to find funny in it. You know, what the dark side to that is that, you know, that a lot of what was funny, that, you know, the sport of cycling was sort of the punchline. Not in ways, admittedly, that are not pretty well deserved in a lot of ways, but you know, to see the sport be the butt of the joke, you know, I think even as a cycling fan, I found things to find pretty funny in that. But you know, all things being equal, could they pick on track and field instead?
I don't know. I don't, you know, obviously whoever this producer and director and all of that who put this thing together obviously loved the idea. And I have to say, I don't care what you think about him, I thought the star of the show was absolutely Lance Armstrong.
Now, see, I have to disagree with you there. I wrote about this in Velo News.
Oh, good. I can't wait to read it.
the part of Tour de Pharmacie that I found most troubling, actually, was Lance Armstrong.
Really?
Presence there. And maybe it's just too soon, but I think, you know, having Lance, and I guess the concern that I wrote about in the magazine is this question of what is the public's perception of the sport of cycling.
Well, that's true.
You know, and already, you know, the sort of undercurrent of that movie is sort of what the public, you know, if the public in America knows anything about cycling, we've had this struggle with doping over, you know, 100 years or more, and certainly they know the story of Lance Armstrong. And you know, Armstrong, at least to the contemporary kind of American public, is you know, arguably the man most responsible right now for helping to sort of perpetrate that reputation for the sport. So to see him in there, it just felt like the joke was sort of on the fans at that point. You know, I have a fair amount of sympathy, actually, for Lance, and have had a chance to, you know, to meet him and to know him a little bit. You know, I can see where he feels as though he is being kind of singled out as the scapegoat for a pretty dark era in the sport. But I don't know, I wasn't thrilled. I didn't find it all that funny to have him in there.
Well, I just thought he was, you know, he was the butt of the joke in a way. So
that is true.
There was, I mean, it is X-rated at best. So for those who haven't seen it, who might want to see it, it's on HBO. I think it's still streaming this month, but it is, be prepared for a very crude 45 minutes. And it's short, you know, it is crude.
It is short and it is crude. Be prepared for, anything that you might consider crude is pretty well in there.
But it was,
you know,
all fair game.
Being equal, it really was. It was very funny.
It was very funny. Well, so what's next? What's next for Dan?
Well, more of the same. We got the Vuelta coming up.
Right.
It sounds like Chris Froome is planning to try to go for back-to-back Grand Tour titles. So
wow.
We'll see how all that goes. You know the interesting thing, and I will tell you, I'm kind of, from year to year, a little bit lukewarm on the Vuelta, but you know, one of the neat opportunities potentially out of all of the injuries in this year's tour is that we may have kind of a bumper crop of folks, assuming they're healed up, you know, maybe who wouldn't otherwise have been at the Volta, you know, having a chance. I have not yet heard whether Peter Sagan, for example, is going to be at the Volta, but he's certainly healthy and has shaved his head. I don't know if you saw that, Diane.
But, no, I haven't.
He has absolutely shaved it bald. So after years of getting into almost like that Forrest Gump marathon runner.
That long, look, beautiful hair.
He is bald as a cue ball right now. So, but, you know, I haven't heard if he's going to be there, but, you know, he certainly is healthy and in you know, good condition for a Grand Tour. So, you know, it may be that we've got some interesting stuff to watch there at the Volta.
Wow, I just pulled up a picture of him. I would not have recognized him.
He definitely does look different.
Okay, then. All right. Well, for those who haven't seen him, just type in Peter Sagan shaves his head, and you're going to see it right there. And it's like, who is that? Really? All right. Well, we'll talk again soon. Thanks again for talking with me. It's always fun to catch up with you.
Always fun to check in. Anytime, Dan.
All right.
So
take
much.
Care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Dan Worry joined me from his office in South Carolina. We disagreed on a couple of things. I still think podium girls are okay, though. We need to take a break. We will be right back to head on out to Boulder to speak with champion triathlete Lauren Goss.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
We're back, and as promised, we're going to Boulder to speak with triathlete Lauren Goss. Hi, Lauren. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
It is my pleasure, and I want to congratulate you on, so far, what's been a great year. You've been on the podium every event you've entered in 2017.
Yeah, I have. It's been a long time coming, though. It's funny people see results, but they forget, like, all the years of work. And, you know, you finally have good luck, and then everything goes well. So I'm just rolling high for as long as I can.
Well, I can tell you it's that, you know, 20-year overnight sensation. We talk about that all the time. Well, let's talk a little bit about your background, where you grew up, what sports interested you as a youngster, and how you got into triathlon, which is, of course, a great event.
I was a Navy brat, so I am originally from Charleston, South Carolina, but we lived in California, San Diego, and we also lived in Virginia Beach. So I moved around a lot. I did softball, basketball, and swimming growing up. Swimming was my main focus, and I continued swimming pretty seriously until I was 15 years old, and I got super burnt out, and I just quit the sport, honestly. And I just did school, and then I went off to college at Clemson University, and I did no sports until my junior year of college. I was dating a guy, and he did triathlon, so I got into it. And I kind of missed swimming. I hadn't been in the pool in about 5 years, and so I got in the pool, and automatically I just remembered why I loved swimming, and I was pretty good naturally at running, but cycling was a big, big struggle for me. I have been working on it ever since. Yeah, now I'm starting to love cycling. So I feel like I have so much room to grow in cycling because I just got into it so late in my life.
Yeah, cycling is one of those addictive sports. Once you get into it, it's like, oh, how did this happen now? Why didn't this happen before? I want to ask you a little bit about your university days at Clemson. You actually majored in biological sciences. Did it ever occur to you that you had a career in professional sports?
No, actually, it didn't. I took the GRE after college, and I got into a physician assistant school, PA school, and that was my plan. But I did well at the collegiate national championships, and USA Triathlon had offered me kind of like a little stipend to race and see how I fared on the Olympic circuit and just, you know, see how I did. So I told my parents, I was like, I'm going to do 1 year of triathlon just to see how it is. I'd be really sad if I didn't do it. And, you know, it's not really something you can go back to. So I was like, I'm going to just put school on hold 1 year and just see how I do. And my parents were like, that's fine, but we're not going to financially support you. So if you want to do this, we'll emotionally support you, but you're going to have to get a job. because we're not paying for you to do it. So I was working two jobs, a bike shop and a run shop, and I was getting a little bit of funding from USA Triathlon to buy some flights during races. But other than that, it was very tough, and I was just crashing with friends, like living in bunk beds, sleeping on couches, trying to like pay rent with equipment I was getting that I didn't need. And I mean, the struggle was very tough, but I appreciated everything I had, and I think it made me more hungry to like succeed, because I knew I couldn't continue the sport unless I made a living out of it. Like, I couldn't say I was a professional and it was a hobby. Like, I actually had to make money. So it really forced me to study the business side of triathlon and to learn how to get sponsors and exactly what I needed to do to have good sponsorship. And I really studied it. And I feel like now I have a great partnership with all of my sponsors. But that wasn't, you know, people ask me, how do you get your sponsors? Well, it wasn't easy, you know. I really, really studied it. And I really did everything I could to get where I'm at. And it was tough. It's not just swim, bike, run. And a lot of people think that's what it is. There's a whole other side of the business side of it if you want to make a career out of sport. So I tried to do all the little things that I could to make it. And fortunately, I'm still going. So I'm doing okay right now.
It's interesting that you say that, because not too many people talk about that side of it. You know, yes, I love to bike, I love to swim, I love to run, you know, I love to enter races, all, but it's not an inexpensive life. Cycling equipment is outrageously expensive right now, and entry fees and travel, people don't see, and you have to eat and you have to sleep and you have to train. So more power to you, Lauren.
Oh, thank you.
What's your preferred distance? Which event is most interesting to you and the one that you seem to be most successful doing?
My favorite distance is the Olympic distance racing. So it's around a 1,500 meter swim, 40 kilometer bike, and 10 kilometer run. It takes around 2 hours. It's a pretty much all out effort from the start. So there's not much thinking, you know, you're not pacing really. You're not thinking about nutrition. And so you really can just focus on racing the people around you. And I really get excited about that. It motivates me. The 70.3 distance, the Ironman races, are a little more popular right now, and sponsors really would like the athletes to do those races, just because I think there's more amateur athletes doing those, more exposure. Unfortunately, I'm not as good at that distance yet, but I'm still trying to do at least 4 or 5 70.3 races a year and just build on it. And, you know, hopefully over time I'll get stronger and I'll feel more confident over that distance. But right now I really enjoy Olympic distance racing, so I'm trying to do as many of those as I can this year.
So let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Lauren Goss. She is a professional triathlete. She has a very interesting perspective on the sport, which I like a lot. You gave an interview to, I've never heard of it before, Hold Fast Health this June, and stated that you've never had a serious injury, which is wonderful. That's fabulous. But how do you attribute the good fortune of being so healthy and staying mostly injury-free? What is it that you're doing?
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate to never have a big injury. Like, I don't know how I've escaped it. I'm sure there's one coming somewhere. But
well, hope not.
I hope not. Yeah. First of all, I have a very clean diet. I'm plant-based, so I'm vegan, so I don't eat any animal products. So it's no meat, it's no poultry, fish, no eggs, no dairy. It sounds very daunting, but it's very actually easy. It just takes a little bit more planning. I get my work once a week, so I stay on top of that. And I think that's something people, they ignore because A, it's expensive, and B, it's time-consuming. You know, they don't want to get the massage and chiropractor because it is expensive. I do a lot of stretching, and I do strength training 3 times a week. And that's another area where I feel athletes who have time restrictions, who are also working, you know, or have a family, that's the first thing to go, because, you know, if you're doing triathlon or cycling or running, you just want to do swim, bike, run. Like, you don't really want to do, you know, you don't really want to go lift weights in the gym. You don't feel as good when you leave. You know, you don't feel like you've got something accomplished. But I think in the end, doing strength training is what will keep you injury-free in the long run. I also run in Hokas, and that provides a lot more cushioning, so I don't have tight calves. And so, I don't know, I attribute other things to while I'm still healthy and not had an injury yet.
How old are you?
I'm 29 years old, almost 30.
Yeah, well, that's what usually comes after 29. But that's, you know what? You sound really young and healthy, which is a good thing, I think. Do you have any pre-race rituals or superstitions? You know, I know a lot of people. I know that sounds like a silly question, but I think people are very ritualistic when they are professional athletes.
I don't have any. I like to race in all parts of the world. I really love South America. You know, I like racing in Mexico. I like racing in Central America. I like going to China and race. So I go to all these bizarre places to race solely because I like to see new places. If I'm going to do this as my job, you know, I like to get out of the U.S. as much as possible and travel because it's essentially free traveling. So I'm traveling with a purpose. And so I don't have any rituals because I often find myself in very strange places where, you know, you can't really rely on your Whole Foods to have dinner or, you know, get your pizza or whatever, you know, you like to have before your race. I usually travel with all my own stuff to make food. I bring a rice cooker and I bring a NutriBullet. So I'm making smoothies and quinoa and oatmeal and rice, like, before all of my races, and I try to keep that consistent. So I guess my only pre-race ritual is I try to have everything in my own control. So if I show up to a race and there's absolutely nothing, I'll be fine, and I can take care of myself from my hotel room. So I try to just plan ahead as best as possible.
That's really an interesting perspective. I like it a lot. I like it a lot. So this is a really weird question. What do you think you're going to do when you retire from racing? And maybe you're going to keep racing until you're into your 40s and 50s, which is great by me. But what do you think you would like to do beyond triathlon?
Well, I guarantee you I won't be racing in my 40s or 50s. I probably have about 5 or 6 more years left of racing professionally. I love it. But, you know, it does take away from normal life activities. Like, you can't go to happy hour with your friends. You can't just go on a vacation and shut off. And even going to bed, you know, you're like, I have to have good sleep tonight because I have to train tomorrow. I love it. But, you know, at some point I'd like to just have a normal, different life and start a new, different career. I'm really into nutrition and diet, so I think I'll do something along that line. I don't know what, but that's what I'm passionate about, is nutrition. So I hope to do something with that down the road. And I also want to have a family and be a mom. I don't know, maybe pick up like Pilates or tennis and do that too. I don't see myself going back to PA school though. I'm glad I didn't do that. I don't think I'd be happy, honestly, stuck in the hospital all day. I really don't. So I'm glad I didn't end up going down that road. And I think whatever I do next will probably be something on my own time and schedule because that's what I'm used to. I'm not sure I can like have a boss or sit at a desk, honestly, just because I've been doing my own career so long, right? So I think I'll do something with nutrition under my own business.
Well, you obviously take good care of yourself right now. So what would be wrong with you continuing to do that and turn it into a business? I think it's a great idea. So I want to kind of switch gears, no pun intended. And we've been talking on the show recently with several psychologists and some other people about athletes, whether they're professional or not, who tend to self-sabotage themselves. They torpedo their own goals. How do you keep yourself up and positive and on the podium so that you don't do things like, oh, I can't do that? Or do you have ways of doing that? Or is it just naturally who you are?
This is actually interesting. I've been talking a lot about this. I train with a lot of athletes, and I constantly see this happening. I train with them. I see how talented and fit they are, and then they go to races, and something always happens, and I don't understand, like, what it is. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and he goes, Lauren, I think I'm just self-sabotaging myself. I don't feel confident, so I just always something goes wrong, but I kind of know it's going to happen before. Like, I don't check over my bike before the race, and like then I have a bike issue and I blame myself. And you know, I get it, because we all have this pressure we put on ourselves and from outside sources, and we just want to, you know, like make ourselves proud and like the people we're racing for. And you know, if something's not going our way, it's so much easier just for something to happen in close than, you know, just to say I just had a bad day. So I struggle with that too sometimes, but I've kind of just backed off a little, and like when I feel like I have pressure, I just step away and I'm like, okay, it's just triathlon, and, like, no one's really even paying attention to this. You know, like, we all think it's such a big deal, like, what we're doing, but really there's so many other things going on in this world right now. Like, you know, no one cares about your result at a race, honestly. Like, nobody does. Like, the people in your life do, but, like, it's not a big deal at the end of the day. So if I just have this new, like, mindset, like, if I'm healthy and I'm able to complete this race, I'm going to complete it, whether I have a terrible result, whether I'm walking, or whether I'm winning the race, you know? I've learned so much more from races where I've failed than races where I've won. So I try to just take away something from every race I enter, and even if it's a bad day, you know, I'm not going to, like, quit. I'm just going to keep going and hopefully take away something to the next race, and it'll help me, you know, be a better athlete at the end of the day. So quitting's not usually an option for me.
Well, and that's interesting that you say that, because I remember years ago we would sponsor a rider. And I remember him specifically. He was so talented and so fast, and always would not, you know, have a problem, like drop the chain, be in the wrong gear, you know, have a flat, whatever. And you could see that it was self-sabotage, that he was doing it, you know, and it's always fascinated me about that. And I've always said to people, I don't care how fast you are, I just want you to just finish. Just like you said, just finish the race.
You have to finish for your sponsors, for your family, for your friends. Like, a lot of people are behind you and following you, and I just feel like I might let down people just by not finishing. And, I mean, everyone's going to like you the same, whether you have a bad day or a good day.
Right,
you know?
Right.
No one really cares. Like, so I just try to have my equipment, you know, and prepared as possible. Earlier this year, I was doing a half Ironman, the Pan American Championships in Monterey, and I was having the best race, best 70.3 race of my career, and I was winning with 3 minutes, and I had 9 miles left on the bike, and I had a flat tire. And it was my first flat tire of my whole career. Okay, I've been racing 7 years, so my first flat tire. And honestly, I was at such peace with it. I was like, I did everything I could to be prepared for this day. This is not fun, and this happened. And I rode my flat in, and I finished the race. You know, I got third place, so I was still happy, but could I have won? Yes. Should I have won on that day? Yes. But, like, sometimes things happen. So I have this new mantra. Oh, if something happens, like, it happens for a reason, and we're just going to keep carrying on, you know? But I'm going to finish the race, whether it's a good or a bad result, because I have to. I owe it to myself. You know, this is my job. So I'm going to finish what I came to do. So.
I totally agree. So these are my fun questions, and I'm going to ask them to you. What do you do for fun and relaxation?
Well, I love cooking, and
ooh,
so I'm always making new recipes. I'm always hosting dinner parties for my friends. I really enjoy wine, so I go to happy hour with my girlfriend sometimes to have some wine. And that's probably it.
Okay.
I love cleaning. I'm, like, obsessed with cleaning my house. I know it sounds crazy, but I love it. I love vacuuming. These are things that, like, make me happy.
If he wasn't married, I'd have a guy for you. You'd have to compete for the vacuum. So what's your
love the vacuum. My Dyson, I love it. My $500 vacuum.
What's your favorite food?
Oh, my favorite food. That's tough. Right now, I'm really into, like, avocados. I, like, make, my favorite foods are, like, avocado and chia seed pudding. And,
okay,
like, mango, like, really strange things. But those, I love working with those three things, and I feel like you can make a good meal out of them. So I use those a lot. My favorite cheat meal is probably French fries. I'm obsessed. After a race, that's all I'm craving, or, like, French fries and a beer, and that's it. That's all I want.
So yeah, carbs.
That's my guilty go-to.
I got it. What kind of music do you like?
Oh, I really love country music. Honestly, I'm from South Carolina, so, you know, the country music still sticks with me.
Got it. And do you have any pets?
Well, this is a sad story, but I adopted 2 rescue cats, and they were so cute. They were 4 months old, and I raised them for 2 years. But then I started traveling so much, and I just didn't feel like it was fair for them just to sit in my house alone. So my mom actually adopted them from me. My parents did. And so now I guess they have my kids. My parents are watching the kids.
Well, it's not sad.
And they're like, well, we're shipping those things back to you when you're done racing. But they love them. They love them. Every day I'm getting photos and videos, and my mom's like, oh, I got this.
Well,
like, new cat tower for cats. And they're obsessed. So, like, I'm happy they're still in my life. But, unfortunately, it's just really hard being single and living alone and, like, not having a roommate and having pets and traveling for 2 weeks, you know, like, all the time. And so it was probably a bad decision to get them, but I'm glad I got them in the end because my parents were really happy.
Exactly. So. Well, Lauren, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for talking with me. And keep racing. Obviously, you're doing well. What's your next event? What's coming up?
Yeah, so I have a month of training here in Boulder. And then I'm going off to race. My next big race is the Beijing International Triathlon. So
Ooh.
It's in China. It's on September 10th. It'll be on CBS. It's on TV, not live. It'll be airing like in November, I believe. But it's a huge race, huge prize purse, invite only. They only invite 6 women and 6 men around the world. And you get to race in this really beautiful course in China. And it's a really special event. So I'll head over there on September 4th. It'll be my 3rd time racing the event. I won in 2015, and last year I was 4th. So I hope to have a better race this year. So that's my next big one.
Well, good luck with it. We will watch it. And thank you so much for talking with me. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lauren Goss, what an interesting young lady. She certainly has a great perspective about her sport and about herself, from being a physician's assistant to getting into nutrition, which I think is a great field. We all could use a little lesson in nutrition now and then. We need to take another quick break, and then we'll be back to talk with the founder of Yuba Cargo Bikes, Ben Sarazen. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Back, and as promised, we're heading out to California to speak with Ben Sarazen, the founder of Yuba Cargo Bikes. Hi, Ben. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
My pleasure. Good morning. Well, good afternoon.
It's afternoon. You're in California. I'm in Ohio. We don't often talk about cargo bikes, so I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. We need to probably talk more about them. Tell us a little bit about Ben and the road that took you to founding this company, Yuba Bikes.
So, yeah, thanks. I mean, Yuba Bike is, our specialty is to design and make bikes that carry things. And over the years, I've always enjoyed various sports and various activities, and I just always love to use my bikes for transportation. And I was kind of like, how do you make the bike more useful? How do you get to carry like all your groceries? How do you get to carry a kayak? How do you get to carry more friends on the back of your bike? And that's kind of what led me to design and create bikes that would be more practical for carrying things.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in between France and Germany in a town called Strasbourg.
You have a wonderful accent. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The good thing about that area is that it was an easy place to cycle, to bike, and, bike were used, especially in the town of Strasbourg, you know, just really for getting around. It was the most convenient way to get from one side of the city to the next.
Well, the category is really expanding today, I think. When I first saw a few cargo bikes emerging on the West Coast, they seem to be an anomaly, but now you have a really broad line of bikes. Who's your core customer? Who buys Yuba bikes?
Most of the people who would like to enjoy their bikes are, we have a lot of parents, a lot of young families with kids, say 1-year-old, still 9 or 10-year-old, and with people looking for solutions to on how to carry one or two kids safely and easily by bike, and being able to replace car trips that we usually have to do driving. So they found the solution with Yuba bikes, the very small we have, and they're able to run errands and take kids to, you know, sport practices, to school, and it really enables them to be a little more local and have an interaction with their urban or suburban environment that's a little more friendly.
How big is the cargo bike category?
Big in terms of number?
Yeah, I mean, I guess we don't have to say, well, numbers, but maybe percentage-wise based on adult bikes mainly, not the kids' bikes, but because I know you make an adorable kids' cargo bike, it's really cute. But I'm talking about a full-size bike.
I think it's still pretty pretty small. However, when you go to a large American city, such as San Francisco or New York or Portland, or even a place like Boulder, you're going to end up seeing Yuba cargo bikes on the road or and other cargo bikes. So they are pretty visible items, but I feel that most of them are probably on the road. And there are a lot of bikes in general, and a lot of them are in garages. So I think all quantities are pretty small, but our visibility is pretty high.
Yeah, it's sort of like a tandem. You know, we ride a tandem, and you don't see a lot of them, so you really notice them. So I understand what you're saying. So you make a whole bunch of different styles of cargo bikes. Tell us a little bit about the different styles and what makes them different from one another.
There are multiple ways to look at this, and one of your previous questions was also asking about who uses a cargo bike. One thing I didn't say is that there are a lot of people that do not have kids that are using the bikes just to carry their groceries. They just want looking for a better bike that makes it easier for them to run errands or go on a trip or go on a picnic. And I don't know if you've seen The Adventure of Mike and Bigsby, the dog Bigsby, traveling cross-country back and forth multiple times on an electric Yuba bike.
I've heard about it, but I have to admit I haven't seen it.
Yeah, it's an amazing adventure. If you can follow them on social media or website, you'll really have a kick out of it. Regarding the model, so we kind of like look at them depending on how much stuff do you want to carry. So we have a model that can carry up to 440 pounds, and you know, I think the smallest payload we have is about 200 pounds. And then we have a cargo is located on the front. We call that a front loader or back seats. Well, and that bike is called a Supermarché. And most of the other bikes have an extended rack where you can carry one, two, three, and some people carry even four kids or one or two adults on the back of the bike.
Wow, big payloads.
Massive payloads.
Yeah. I want to ask you about your new bike, your Spicy Curry Bosch. It's a pretty sophisticated machine. Tell us a little bit about it, because that's what brought me to you, was that particular bike. I got a press release about it.
So most of you listeners are going to know the name Bosch, who is this huge German company that makes dishwasher and washing machines and car parts. And they got into the electric bike market about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago now. And them stepping into the game really changed how the market was for electric bike. Until them entering the European electric bike market, it was, you know, not going that well. I mean, electric bikes were selling, but it was kind of a small growth in Europe. And then as soon as they entered the market, I mean, that's when the market exploded, because people started getting confidence into this Bosch brand name and the reliability that people see into German product. And so Bosch makes this very good electric motor. So it's the combination of a motor and a battery. And when you add that to a light aluminum bicycle like the Spicy Curry, it creates a car replacement. It's almost a slice of a car. The only thing it does not have is weather protection. He goes up to 20 miles per hour. It can climb pretty steep hills up to 20-25% with load. So it's a pretty incredible machine, and it gives you a range of probably about 35 to 40 miles, depending on, you know, the payload, the wind, the terrain, and so forth.
So is it electric assist, or is it either it's on or off?
It is what we call a pedal assist. So have your you can select different level of assist. You can select no assist, obviously, so you just pedal, or you can select different level of assist from 1 to 4, pretty much. And as you're applying power on the pedal, the motor kicks in and provides different level of assistance. So, you know, it's not a motorcycle or a scooter. You can get some pretty good exercise while you're pedaling an electric bike, especially when you have a load. I mean, a few weeks ago, I was carrying one of my kids going up a pretty steep hill, and I can tell you I was using the assist a little bit, but I was getting a serious workout.
Right. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ben Sarazen. He's the founder of Yuba Cargo Bikes. I wanted to ask you about riding a cargo bike in general. Is there a learning curve? How different is riding a bike that's that long with a rack on the back from riding, say, just a standard multi-speed road bike or even a mountain bike?
Diane, I think that's an awesome question. Because when people see cargo bikes at the beginning, they're somewhat intimidated. You know, the bike's a little longer, 30 inches longer or more. In case of the front loader, it's probably, you know, maybe 2 feet or a foot and a half more than a regular bike with this huge platform in the front. And one of the most amazing thing is when people get on the bike and start riding, even with a load, they feel absolutely comfortable. They feel like, oh wow, this is like riding a regular bicycle. I can't even feel that it's a little longer. Oh, I can't even feel the cargo on the back. So that's the great thing about this type of cargo bike, like the Mundo cargo bike or the Boda Boda cargo bike, is they are extremely easy to ride and they're safe. I mean, the long wheelbase provides more stability and safety to a novice rider. Like, it's extremely rare or almost impossible, for example, to go over the handlebar while riding a cargo bike because you have this much longer tail on the back.
Right. Oh, I can understand that. I absolutely can. I was just wondering does it handle any differently with cargo? So if you put panniers on a regular bike, you have to really figure out how to handle it. It's gonna, or a handlebar bag. You know, it changes the dynamics of the ride. How about with a cargo? Obviously, a cargo bike was made to carry cargo. Does it make it more stable to have cargo in it?
I wouldn't say it makes it more stable. What I was trying to say is there's almost no difference. When people get on the bicycle with cargo, they feel that it rides like a regular bike without load. And there are a few reasons to that. I mean, one thing we've been paying a lot of attention over the years is, you know, our engineering is making sure the right quality will be optimal for the people. So we have frames that are slightly overbuilt where the rack connects to the frame, so which creates a very stable frame when carrying cargo, being boxes or groceries or kids. So that is very important. Like, it makes it easier for someone that doesn't have much experience to get on the cargo bike when the frame is also well built.
Well, and it seems like an easy on-off. Your bikes aren't real high up off the ground. What are the wheel sizes? They look like they're maybe 20-inch wheels, 26-inch wheels?
So we got different options. Most of our bikes have 26 inches wheel in the front and the back, but we like the Spicy Curry Bosch that you mentioned that we make in collaboration with a company in Southern California called Rally Electric. The Spicy Curry Bosch has a 26-inch wheel in the front and a 20-inch rear wheel in the back. And what that does, it enables offer lower center of gravity, so it makes it a little easier to carry cargo, like small kids or large boxes.
Interesting. Can I shift our conversation a little bit about some things you've said in the past. I kind of liked hearing them. You spoke about entrepreneurship in an interview with Bike Rumor back in 2013. I see today's bike shops, and I was a bike dealer for many years. I got out in 2012. Today, the bike shops are struggling, and retail is changing. What do you see that has changed in your business, and how have you been able to stay ahead of those changes in this kind of fluctuating retail market?
Wow, that is a good and a tough question at the same time. I think I was at the conference a few years ago, and someone from People for Bike, the organization, they were talking about why Americans don't ride bikes. And one of the main reasons why Americans don't ride bikes was there were two reasons. One was because people don't know where to go. So you're in a given town and you're not very experienced, but you don't know where it's safe to go, where you can be comfortable with your kid. And the second big reason was because the bike cannot be operated as a flat tire because it was in the garage for the entire winter or 2 years. Brakes that are rusty. And that's where it connects to the bike dealer. If there are no bike dealers in a given town, that means people are not going to have places to tell them where they can ride or tell them where or someone that is going to be able to fix and repair their bikes. However, I think the chance and what we've been doing as a company is trying to bring more people to cycling. And a lot of people out there are interested in using bikes for recreation, for transportation, for fitness. A lot of them do not know where to start. And that's where, you know, bike brand or bike company like us and bicycle dealers have to be out there to educate and provide information and help people to get into cycling. And that's the value I believe that bicycle dealers can add to their community, is they have to keep on doing this education to help people get into cycling and be this essential pillar of cycling in the community, not only someone who retails a product.
So I absolutely agree with you that education is a huge piece of the pie. One of the problems that dealers keep saying they have is that they can't compete with people like Amazon. And my answer to that has always been, when you think you're competing with Amazon or Walmart, you're looking at the wrong things. You have to reinvent yourself. And education is one way to do that. So maybe bring people in to, you know, tell them about rides, to tell them about how to get their bikes fixed. I'm not sure what the right answer is, but I know that competing with Amazon is the wrong answer.
Yeah, I mean, if the product is a commodity, there's no way for a bike shop to win or any other retailer in other industries. I mean, if you're just selling a product, against an online retailer that is much better than you at negotiating pricing and getting terms and so forth, I mean, there's no way you can win. Where the retailers can win if they offer a positive solution to people, so people understand that the retailer is an important element of healthy element of the community. You were talking about electric bikes earlier. I mean, this is an important case where, you know, people look sometimes at electric bikes and like, whoa, $3,000. I mean, that's a lot of money. I could find one online for, you know, $1,200. Well, you know, the difference there, it's a bike online for $1,200 that does not have a very strong company behind it, with parts coming, pretty cheap parts of not very good quality coming from China, without anybody assembling it and with no support. So if the product is broken, you know, no one is there to support the product. If you buy your electric bike from a local dealer, that dealer is choosing the best product possible with the strongest support. That means if the bike is a problem or if the bike needs to be repaired in 2 years from now, that person is going to be there to help you. So this is where, like, the dealer and the brands, we have to work together in explaining those points in the equation. It's like, this is, you know, this service has a cost, but this cost is of tremendous value for the consumer.
Yeah, I don't think dealers have understood how to price their service. It is what they have to offer. And if they're good at it, they'll stay busy and they'll stay profitable. I absolutely agree. I totally agree. Well, Ben, I want to ask you my three funny questions now, and then we're going to tell people how to find out more about your bikes. How's that?
That sounds good. Thank you, Diane.
What's your favorite food?
Can you guess?
Oh, please don't say pizza.
Spicy curry.
Oh, spicy curry. Of course it is. What kind of music do you like?
I love salsa music. Yeah, that's one of my favorite, salsa and Latino American music. I love that.
Let's see. It goes right along with spicy curry, salsa, and do you have any pets?
Not today. We used to have a couple of cats, but unfortunately it was passed.
Oh, I bet your kids are bugging you for more, right?
Kids are bugging us for more, absolutely. But not currently. We have a pet on our team with Bixby, the dog I was talking about earlier,
right,
that Mike Minnick is traveling and just broke the world record on an electric bike with Bixby on the back. It's a pretty cool adventure, so that's kind of our dog.
Well, go ahead and tell our listeners how to find out more about Yuba Bikes.
So Yuba Bikes can be found online. It's yubabikes.com, start with a Y, YubaBikes.com. And obviously you can find us on Facebook or Instagram. Just type in Yuba Bikes. And looking forward to seeing you out there on the road riding cargo bikes and with a big smile on your face.
Thank you so much for talking with me, Ben. This was an interesting conversation. I learned a lot about cargo bikes.
Oh, thank you so much, Diane, and have a great end of the summer.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye for now.
Well, that's our show for this week. I'd like to thank Ben Sarazen for all of his interesting conversation about cargo bikes and about the bicycle business as a whole. Of course, my thanks goes to Dan Worry for his insights into bike racing and to Lauren Goss for her insights into the sport of triathlon. I hope you enjoyed our show this week. We will be back next week with a brand new edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.